Welcome to this season of Future Makers Brain and Mental Health. I'm Professor Belinda Lennox. I'm a psychiatrist and a researcher here in Oxford. And this season, you'll be joining me as we demystify the science behind the most complex object in the known universe, our brains, and look at the wide-reaching impacts of mental illness on individuals and society. I'll be introducing you to some of Oxford's best academic minds working to solve the greatest challenges in brain and mental health. And I'll also be speaking to guests from beyond the university to bring their perspectives and lived experience and get a sense of the impact of what we're doing. Join us as we discover how Oxford is shaping the future of brain and mental health research.
Okay, welcome to an episode of Future Makers, where we're going to be talking about mental health in the workplace with the legend that is Sir John Kerwin, who has said that I'm allowed to call him JK. Sir John Kerwin was a New Zealand rugby player, winner of the World Cup, complete legend in the world of rugby, but perhaps even more so since he has left rugby, but is one of the first people with a really prominent public platform to speak openly about his own history of mental illness and be an advocate for mental health. And he's now founded Groove, focusing on workplace wellbeing. And he was knighted in 2012 for services to mental health and rugby. And it's a complete pleasure to have you with us, JK.
Absolutely lovely to be here. Thank you for inviting me. I'm in this part of the world too, which is really good. So I'm sitting in my Italian home.
Well, it's a complete pleasure to have you with us. And of course, you're a seasoned professional when it comes to podcast making as well. So in safe hands. I suppose I'll be really interested to hear how you ended up in this world of mental health advocacy, I guess.
Yeah, look, I wanted to jump out of a window one night. Pretty much. I was hiding my anxiety. So I was an anxiety-based depressant. As you know, they're two different illnesses. You can have anxiety without them falling into depression. But what I did was I started getting anxiety attacks. I mean, retrospectively, looking at it, I probably started having them when I was 13 or 14, maybe. Ignored them. I'd go back to relatively normal. And then, I made the Auckland team at 18 and the All Blacks at 19. And they just kept accelerating and I just kept ignoring them because I didn't know what they were. You know, I just thought, because my reference back then, and, if you've got a young audience, they might not remember this movie, but my reference to mental health was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. So I thought that if I spoke about my mental health, I was going to get locked up with Jack Nicholson and the chief, the big American Indian guy. So I had no awareness of mental health, didn't know what was going on, hid my anxiety. And then one day, the best way I explain it is your anxiety just doesn't go away. So you go from anxiety attacks. I was having probably on my worst days about 5 or 10 a day. And then they just didn't go away. And that was depression. But I didn't know what it was. I also had suicidal ruminations. I never planned my own suicide. And for that, I'm eternally grateful to whoever you believe, God, Allah, or whoever you believe. So I'm eternally grateful that I never planned my own suicide, but I certainly had suicidal ruminations. I was on an all-black tour in Argentina. And the way I explain it is, when you're in this hell, and it is hell, a minute feels like an hour feels like a day, and a day feels like a week. So by the time I got to every single day, because I was faking shit as well, Linda, I was just faking stuff. So no one externally knew I was unwell. So I've got all this internal turmoil and I'm trying to hide it. I'm trying to be a high performance athlete, a public figure. And I was just sick of fighting. You know, at the end of every day, I'm just so tired. I was just so tired of fighting this thing. And I remember, looking to my left, I was on the 10th floor of the Hilton Hotel in Buenos Aires, and I just decided to, I was sick of fighting this, so I'm going to run and jump out. And basically, the guy lying next to me said, JK, you've got a good heart. I don't know why he said it. He doesn't know why he said it. We've discussed it since, and we can talk about that later. But he saved my life. I played a test match for the country the next day. So that phrase, JK, you've got a good heart. I said that to myself every 10 seconds for the next 4 days. You know, I played a test match the next day. It was like looking at myself in a dream. I scored 2 tries, totally irrelevant. But I think what that moment made me do was reach out and get help. So I flew home back to New Zealand with the All Blacks, still faking shit. You know, the aeroplane flights were terrible because I was having anxiety. As anyone who's studied anxiety, one of the things that anxious people like is the ability to leave. So aeroplanes were pretty tough because you can't leave. But I got home and I went and saw my doctor. The interesting thing was that my doctor was the All Black doctor. I hadn't spoken to him. We'd been away for, you know, 4 or 5 weeks together. And what he said changed my life. He said, JK, it's an illness, not a weakness. I went, wow. Because as you'll probably know, with all the brains you have at Oxford, you know, one of the things that depression does, takes away your self-esteem, takes away your self-confidence, and takes away your enjoyment in life. And that's part of the illness. I just didn't know that at the time. So if you think about that, I had no self-worth. I thought I was just lucky to be an All Black. You know, the second thing is I had no confidence in myself. I just thought, what is going on here? And I didn't enjoy anything. So you're just in this sort of horrible place. The second thing that happened really was I started to accept my illness because I've been fighting it. And I say this to people now, never give up, but stop fighting it. And the moment I stopped fighting and I just accepted it was the minute that I started to get some space in my brain to actually realize what was going on, step back a bit and understand it. And then I went on this amazing journey for many, many years. It's, you know, I decided a few years later that I was become the face of this in New Zealand. So I became the sort of spokesperson. We did TV ads around anti-stigma. Then we did a hope campaign. About 12 years ago, we created, together with the government, a program called depression.org.nz, which was basically CBT, cognitive behavior therapy, but in the safety of your own home. That won awards all around the world. It's first time ever it's happened, and that was really, really cool. But the reason why I'm sitting in front of you today is that 5 years ago I woke up and I'd done all this work and our suicide rate was going the wrong way. You know, 750,000 people committed suicide last year in our beautiful little country, New Zealand. You know, by the end of today, a New Zealand male will be dead by tomorrow night. 2 males and 1 female. In Australia, you know, 8 suicides a day, 120 attempts. And so if you've been the face of this and your goal was to change stuff, I'd failed, right? So I sit there and think, shit, I failed. What do I need to do? Now, pre my depression, failure was probably something I was so scared of, I kept running from it. What my depression taught me to do was sit with failure, give it a cuddle, learn from it, and then move on. So very quickly, I thought, okay, what do I need to do? And I don't know what your thoughts are, Belinda, or what Oxford's thoughts are, but This is a bit like smoking and heart disease in the 80s, you know? The government go, well, if everyone's going to keep doing this, we're going to have this massive hole. And I just think anxiety and depression is on the increase and the governments can't afford to keep up with it. In New Zealand, you know, I think we need 15,000 psychiatrists, psychologists and counsellors. I think we've got 4,700. You know, I read about the NHS and people going there and there's just not the numbers of psychiatrists or psychologists to help deal with the problem, right? So I thought, what can I do differently? So two things. I felt that if we're going to change the world, then my reference is One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. So how do we educate kids? So I started a foundation. We looked all around the world to see if there's any programs that actually teach our kids mental health as a curriculum in the schools. So we realized that we wasn't. So we raised about $250,000 and we asked the University of Auckland to create a curriculum And they've created a curriculum called Mighty. That's now in 120 schools. I want to have it for primary schools, by the way. So that's another interesting thing. And then I felt that if what about people sort of, you know, at work age? So that's where we created Groove. We're a SaaS product. We're a product that helps individuals look after their mental health, so preventative mental health. We lift the leaders to talk about this, change the dialogue, make it acceptable to talk about at workplace. And the third thing is we try and optimize the environment within the workplace. And we believe that if we can prove that a well workplace mentally can increase productivity and profitability, then businesses will get involved and will share some of the load of this and, you know, stop pushing people off the cliff, so to speak. So that's a hell of a long answer for your first question, Belinda. So like I said, I've got a bit of a monkey brain and it takes off, but that's why I'm sitting in front of you. I'm pretty passionate about this.
Well, it's a wonderful story. I mean, what an amazing story. And I suppose it's the thing about prevention is that, you can't measure the lives that you've saved so easily, but I'm sure you have saved lives. I'm sure you've saved many lives, actually. Just the shining the light on the stigma associated with mental illness, even just amongst professional sports people, I know that you've fundamentally changed the way that it's recognised. And, you know, there will be young people who are alive today because of you. So, you know, thank you. It's an amazing story. And I suppose I was also thinking as you were talking, you know, thank goodness we're just in a different place to 20 years ago. The acceptance of mental health and well-being, it's part of the language, particularly for young people, I would say, you know. So it is a bit of a paradox, isn't it, how the suicide rate is so stubbornly stuck, despite everybody being so much more aware. And it's difficult to get into, you know, into the reason. I mean, it's complicated, isn't it? But it's kind of what next, I guess. It's that the awareness might be there, but it's actually the interventions and how to actually truly prevent or support people in the workplace effectively. I suppose that's what I'm trying to understand is, you know, what's the evidence base actually is how we can do it well.
Yeah, look, and I think I spoke to a politician once, right? And he said we never get re-voted in or voted out on preventative. You know, it's always the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff around any issue. And if you think about the issues that are facing the world at the moment, you know, environment, we've probably known about the environment for a long, long time. But I think one of the biggest pandemics is actually the mental health of our people. I believe that technology is a beautiful thing. You and I, you know, we're online at the moment and we're chatting. You know, I often leave overseas. I can see my kids when they're overseas. And so there's lots of beautiful thing about technology. But it's also, I believe, increased the anxiety and really the load in our brains, right? So I don't think any of us really have too much capacity left. So we need to learn these basic mental health tools just to free them up, you know. And I think an understanding of your own brain, right? So I don't make any judgment. All I'm saying is that if you have what we call at Groove, the six pillars. So the six pillars are move, chill, enjoy, connect, celebrate, and do. Now, you'll know that based in science, if you do those things in your day, then you will have more capacity and feel better. So for example, let me explain to you the first time I go to my psychiatrist, right? I didn't want to go, right? So I'm your classic male, you know, stupid in retrospect. But back then I go to my doctor. My doctor says to me, you know, JK, it's an illness, not a weakness. Here's two things you should do. You should take antidepressants because you've got suicidal ruminations. And you should go and see a psychiatrist. So this is the same guy that's spending 4 hours in the gym trying to be the best athlete he can. Got a bit of a sore knee, I'd be the first one in the physio room. But then when the doctor says to me, go and see someone about your head, I'm going, nah, get out. I'm not going, you know. Absolutely ridiculous in retrospect. But then I just didn't get better. And so 3 weeks later, I go back and go, well, doc, I'm still not getting better. I'm a little bit more aware, and I got some automatic relief from realizing that it's an illness and not a weakness, blah, blah, blah. He said, take the bloody pills, JK, you know? And so I started taking the antidepressants. Interesting thing, I had to try three before I got the one that suited me. The stupid thing back then was I thought if I take the antidepressant, ta-da, JK's going to be back. You know, it's going to be like an aspirin. It's going to get rid of your headache. That didn't happen. And this is through lack of knowledge. So it took me a while to do that. And then the second thing he said to me was, JK, do you want to be the greatest athlete ever? I said, yeah, that's what I play football for. You know, and he says, well, you go to the physio, you go to the doctor, you go to the gym. Right now, you're the best athlete. I said, no. He said, well, you should go to the psychiatrist. And I went. Now this is another really interesting thing that I try to explain to people. Sometimes you don't connect straight away, right? And so I didn't connect with the first person, but it wasn't his fault. I'm sure he helped a whole lot of people, right? But I just didn't connect. But the second person I went to was an amazing woman, you know, and it took me another 3 weeks to go back, but I sat down and she said, oh, rugby player. I said, yeah, I'm a rugby player. She said, what would you do if you had a tight hamstring? I said, I'd stop and stretch it. Okay, you stop and stretch it, you get up, you keep running, and it gets really, really tight. I said, oh, I'd stop, stretch it, ice it, and then go and see the physio. She said, your brain's no different. And that helped me accept that I had a hamstring in the head. What's the ice and who's the physio? I knew alcohol wasn't the ice because I went to that often. I get absolutely hammered. And that was a bit of a cultural thing as well, which didn't help, but get hammered. And the sad thing is it would give me a little bit of relief for a few hours. But then I'd go back at 100 miles an hour the next day, it'd be 10 times worse. So I knew that wasn't the ice. So what I had to work out was what were some of the things that I could do in my day to give me some capacity back, to give me some relief, to help me, you know, feel better. And that's when I started building my six pillars.
Hello, I hope you're enjoying this episode of Future Makers Brain and Mental Health. If you'd like to learn more about our work here in Oxford, head to ox.ac.uk/brain or let us know what you think on social media using the hashtag OxfordBrain.
So you're talking about the influence of technology and why perhaps sort of young people today have particular pressures and difficulties. And I suppose I sort of want to come on to thinking about workplace and what organisations can do to support the well-being of their employees. Because, I mean, absolutely, at an individual level, we need to recognise mental illness when it's there and we need to treat it properly with our evidence-based treatments. But, you know, people spend a lot of their life in the workplace and there's no doubt that it can enhance or, you know, diminish your well-being by the sort of the organisational culture and you know, the practices that are in place. I mean, what's your what have you learned? What's your sort of understanding as to what I suppose a good workplace well-being strategy looks like?
Well, I think that it needs to go on the agenda, right? And well-being, with no disrespect, is actually a really broad thing, you know. So I talk about preventative mental health. You know, is your inbox, Belinda, ever empty? No.
Of course, you know? It isn't. No.
No, no one's is anymore. So there's this blur between work and home, right? It's now joined. There is no work-life balance. There's just life. And I think you add COVID, you add remote working, you add a whole lot of different things, technology, all this thing. So the capacity in our brains, I think, are full and we've got to free it up. Back in the old days, you know, like my dad used to drive home from work, nothing to follow him. You know, now people are still got an inbox, they're doing work after dinner, they're working on Sundays, and that's okay. But what you need to be able to do is to start freeing up some space in your mind. And it's your mind you need to reboot, you know. I talk about, you know, the computer when it or your phone when it stops, you know. What do? You know, we we turn it off and turn it on again. And it normally works, right? 95%. And we need to do that with our brains. So my philosophy is we need to empower the individual to have a preventative daily mental health plan around how their mind works and the stuff they like. But then we've got to lift the leaders so that they are putting it on the agenda. And it's not like, oh, how's your mental health? You know, it's just what we do every single day. And so, you know, I talk about us, and you'll hear a lot about, and I'm sure you work a lot of, in the space, a psychological safety bridge. So what is a psychological safety bridge? For me, a psychological safety bridge is trust and care, right? So we've really left mental health at the doorstep of our workplaces probably for 150 years. And now very quickly, we need to accelerate it in the doors. So what we talk about is empowering the individual to just start. And we often talk about DOT, just do one thing. Do one thing today for your mental health, right? And for me, for example, when I first went to the psychiatrist, he said, okay, Jacko, now that you've accepted your illness and you're starting to get a bit balance in your brain, how would you like to get good at it? I said, yeah, I'd love to be the All Blacks of depression, you know. And she said, well, what would you like to try? Meditation. And I went, ooh, hey, you got to remember, but well, this is in the 80s, right? If you did yoga, you're a dope smoking surfy freak back then, you know. There's no Lululemon back then, you know what I'm saying? I went to meditation and it was an absolute disaster for me. And we all know that if you can meditate, you should do it. It's amazing for your mental health. But there's a percentage of people that shouldn't meditate. Nah. And I was one of those. I didn't know. So I came out feeling like a complete failure. And so I go back to her and she said, how's that? And I said, that's probably the worst thing I've ever experienced. It brought my anxiety back, blah, 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 blah. She said, well, you've probably got a ruminating mind, JK. And, you know, it's very, very active. So, and then she asked me a few questions like, you know, if the movie doesn't attract your attention within 5 minutes, is your mind gone different directions? And I'm going, yes. She said, well, you've got a ruminating mind. And I can't even spell that. So I just called it Bob the Monkey, right? So my meditation, and, you know, this is part of my six pillars, is I read. You know, I'm a little bit on the dyslexic scale. But I taught myself to read when I was 18. And reading, you know what happens when I read? Bob the monkey goes into his cage and has a banana. So, you know, before I go to sleep at night, if I read, I fall asleep. If I don't, Bob the monkey goes, huge, okay, let's think about all this dumb shit and keep you awake. Another thing I do is I absolutely love cooking. So, you know, nowadays with everyone so busy, you got to do two birds with one stone with your mental health as well. So I love cooking. You know, I think about it during the day and I think about what I'm going to cook that night. And then when I'm cooking, Bob the monkey goes into his cage and has a banana. So two birds with one stone. Cooking's two birds with one stone. But also is going for a walk with my wife because, you know, move, but I also connect. I reconnect with her. So, you know, I started learning these things. I also learned that it's okay if you can't meditate. But as long as you understand your mind, so every single day, and I talk about a daily mental health plan, I read, I move or go for a walk or I cook. And during COVID, I took up the guitar. You know, it sounds like I'm killing a cat in the lounge, but Bob the monkey goes into his cage and has a banana. So all of a sudden, I started putting these things in my day and I was getting relief and feeling better. And I'd go back to her. And she'd say, well, you know, you need to just keep putting those things in your day, you know? And that's what I do. Yeah. Breathing, for example, you know, basic breathing. I walked into her office one day and she said, JK, how would you like to learn how to breathe? I just started laughing. I said, I'm standing in front of you. I'm alive. What do you mean? She said, no, JK, all your shoulders are tense. I can see it. And she just taught me some simple box breathing. And I do that 6 times a day. And when I started doing it, I started getting relief and feeling better. So, you know, we've got to change the dialogue. We've got to make it simple for people. So if we can go into businesses and just do one thing, just do one of those things a day, start putting it in your day. Habitual change, as you will know, Belinda, is one of the hardest things, you know. to change. But if you put these little things in your day and they're easy to achieve, then we do them.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense, and I'm sure resonates with a lot of people. I suppose, what you're saying, you know, I suppose what I'm picking up on is what I can do as a leader in my organisation, as an employer, because a lot, well, in academia, I think the UK, probably in many places around the world, it's a pretty tough place to work, you know. So there was a survey by the Wellcome Trust recently that reported that 70% of researchers report feeling stressed on an average working day. You know, so mental health issues like anxiety and depression are 7 times more prevalent in academia than the broader population. It's a pretty unhealthy place to be working. And there's all sorts of reasons for that. But, you know, we've really got to look after, you know, our brilliant staff that we're completely reliant on for the work that we do at every level. And we're not doing a great job at the moment.
Yeah, look, and I think, and this is that, that's not uncommon in most workplaces at the moment. And that's why, you know, changing the dialogue, having a dot. So one of the things I encourage leaders to do is go into work and talk about their dot. We've got to encourage leaders to start looking after themselves, because then when the leaders start talking about it, then it's okay for the workers. You'll know this. You'll know this 100 million times. You know, if the boss is sending emails at 5 o'clock in the morning, then, you know, people are going to respond. They're going to feel stressed. So there's just some simple things that we can do. But then also, if you start creating a work dot, right, we're going to do a breathing exercise before we start our research, or we're going to go for a walk in between our research, or we're going to journal, whatever. If you start building those things into your day, it just becomes normal. And those things are fundamental, because you can't keep, you know, you can't keep the rhythm up that the world is pushing at us nowadays, because there's less people and more work to do. So yeah, that's what I think. The leaders are fundamental in the workplace. So you're right.
Yeah. Do you think there are some industries that are sort of particularly problematic? I mean, you know, some that still have a sort of an old-fashioned view that, you know, the harder you've got to sort of prove your worth, you know, you're expected to be there for extended hours and, you know, give up the rest of your life to show your dedication to the cause kind of thing. Is there a top target from your point of view of a world that you'd like to change?
Yeah, look, it's a great question, right? And what's happened, I talk a lot about performance care. So what's happened is, you know, you've got performance and you've got care. You've got to bring those together. But also, working is incredibly good for your mental health. I love working. I love achieving my goals. I love doing what I'm doing. If you're ambitious and you want to work 12 hours a day because you want to be a partner, I'm okay with that. But every single day, you've got to look after your mental health, because it's accumulative, right? If you're stressed today and you don't get rid of it, you're going to have it tomorrow, next day. But we have to identify how people can look after themselves on a daily basis and then have some sort of management of your imbalance, right? Because people talk about balance. Balance is not a real reality for me. Managing my imbalances, you know? And so if we can manage your imbalances by having a daily mental health plan, and you go to work and you can take time out to go to the gym, you can take time out to go for a walk, you can breathe, you can take your time, you can do things, work out what it's worth to you around productivity. So I think the future of workplace preventative mental health is actually understanding, by having these daily mental health plans, how much more productive you can be. And so I think most industries are the same. There's other industries that I think need to accelerate into the 20th century around some of the reasons why they were successful in the past, possibly lawyers being one. And I think I know it's changing in New Zealand, but young doctors, how you treated young doctors. And obviously today you've told me that academia is pretty stressful as well. So,
yeah, well, I think there are many that are difficult. I suppose, as I was thinking as you were speaking, I think there has been a growth in acceptance. I think most people will recognise that well-being is important for you know, having happy staff that stay, that, you know, feel connected, that recognize the, you know, feel valued, are going to be more productive, and your company is going to thrive as a result. I mean, it seems, would you agree with that? Do you think most companies would see that this is something that's worth paying attention to?
Yeah, no, I think you mentioned it earlier as well, but and you did right. I think the awareness is there. I think people understand, because amazing organizations like yours are coming out with the stats, you know, 1 in 5 people burnt out, you know, productivity tanking, all sorts of percentages out there. So the knowledge is out there. It's just that well-being has been a little bit fluffy for my liking, you know. What is it? Is it the free yoga? Is it free gym? Is it this? Is it that? You know? And I'm saying, yeah, it's all those things, but I've got to make that decision. So I am convinced, and I am absolutely convinced about this, that it's really about giving the individual a daily mental health plan. Because if you give me meditation, you know what I'm going to say to you? You know, it's not good for my brain. So if we can teach everyone to understand what their daily mental health plan is around the 6 pillars, then they can choose, right? You talk to businesses and they've spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on this one thing and it's had no take up. You know, they've spent $2 on the other thing. It's got a big take up. So we just need to get down to encouraging the individual to understand what keeps them well every day. And that means if it's for you, Belinda, reading, you know, a book under a tree for 15 minutes, then when I see you reading your book under the tree at 11 o'clock, I know that you're looking after yourself because you're going to go back to work and be productive. So the more we share the stuff, the more we understand it, the more we change the dialogue, then we'll go, oh, that's just Belinda. That's what she does. Yeah, that's her daily mental health plan, you know?
Yeah, I think you're completely right. It is the perception of fluffiness, isn't it? It's the sort of intangible nature, and maybe it's not measurable in a very hard way. If we said that this company had a well-being index of zero or whatever, then, you know, and actually it had some kind of implications, or, you know, that they couldn't retain their staff or had more difficulty recruiting, then maybe people would pay more attention to it, perhaps.
I talk about whether you're on the bus or off the bus. I think there's some leaders out there that really, really get this and understand it. You know, I often talk about Bill Gates coming across the Canadian border with, you know, Microsoft in his pocket. What was that, 40 odd years ago now? And he's saying, you know, I'm going to put a laptop on everyone's lap. He did pretty bloody well at that, you know. And then Steve Jobs comes along with the iPhone and says, I'm going to put one of these in everyone's hands. Right.
Yeah.
And I go, yep. That's probably, yeah, that's really good. I remember talking to Luciano Benetton once, and I played for Benetton here in Italy, and I spent some time with him, and I'm intrigued with people like that. And I said to him, you know, how'd you get so rich, mate? And he goes, I invented color. You know, before me, there was black, white, and gray. Yeah. And I thought it was quite an amazing response, right? But what is the future? I mean, do you need any more shit in your life? The future is actually genuine well-being of your people and preventative mental health. And I think the empathy bosses are going to survive. You know, if you look at sport, you know, sport now, the coaches that are surviving are those that have the biggest empathy for their players, those that can combine that performance and that care piece together. You know, the technical side of it is probably irrelevant because you can employ it, right? But it's that performance care that's really, really important. I think workplaces in the next 5 years, if you're not an empathy lead boss and you're genuine about it, then you're going to be really struggling to retain and motivate people and get them perform at the highest level.
Well, I think that's, I don't need to say anything else. I think that's just a wonderful summary completely. Have you come across a company or a leader that really does it well, that can really give us a sort of example of how they've transformed their workplace?
Yeah, I think there's a boss in New Zealand called Steve Yukovich. He runs Kiwi Bank, and he believes this is the future, and he's implemented Groove and he's driven it through the business. He's led by example. I did a podcast with him little while ago. His vulnerability was inspiring, and he's seeing the results. And so I think there's a lot of people out there that get this space, and those that are driving it through the business are getting the results. I think it's the the most important thing that we can all learn. So there's plenty of research out there, as you would know, and I think our goal at Groove is to reach 100 million people and save 100,000 lives, and we think that businesses can do that. On the other side, I think if then we can create Mighty, which is a curriculum for our primary schools, then hopefully in a generation or so, our stats start coming back and we don't have as many sad cases that we're having now.
Completely. Thank you. Well, hopefully I'll be speaking to the academics from the University of Oxford Wellbeing Research Centre, because they've just published a very interesting study where they crowdsourced the data from Indeed, the recruitment company, the website, and they looked at over 1,600 public listed companies where people that had worked for those companies had reported their well-being score. So they responded on how happy they were to work there, whether they had job satisfaction, and whether they had a sense of purpose working there. And then they plotted those data against the sort of the effectiveness of the companies. And I suppose it won't surprise you to realise that those companies with the highest level of well-being had the highest level of productivity, quite substantially. Sort of direct evidence, I guess, that you support your employees and you have a more successful company.
Yeah, look, and I think I love when academia gets together with storytelling, so we can take the science, we can take the facts and mold them into a story and change the dialogue so that it just becomes normal for people. And I think the negative around mental health is it has been caught in it's really dark place sometimes, and I don't want to take anything away from people who are unwell. I want to free up space so that we can get the people the help that they need. And to do that, I think we've got to get rid of the mild to moderate and start really trying to help those that, we're pushing off the cliff, So if we can turn some of those stats from 1 in 5 in the workplace being mild to moderate to 1 in 10 to 1 in 20, then we're going to free up, for the people who really need the care, who might be in those percentages that are born with some sort of mental health issues. So there's still plenty to do, Belinda, and I'm really happy to come up and talk about the stats and the facts and...
Oh, well, there's an invitation. Well, I think that's a wonderful place to stop, actually, because absolutely the focus on mental well-being and the preventative measures in the workplace and for everybody. I mean, this is relevant for absolutely the entire population. But if we could then refocus our efforts, and particularly of the psychiatric workforce, on the more severe mental illness, where really... I would say has been languishing for desperate need for more research and better treatments and really haven't advanced for many decades, then that would be wonderful.
There's so much to be done. There is so much pressure on the workforce in this space that we need to start. And that's why I think business is one of the solutions. If we can free up some space so that the people can work as they need to work, then we'll make strides way quicker, which should be all of our goals.
Yeah. Well, thank you for taking time out of your daughter's wedding celebrations to join us. I've really enjoyed our talk.
It's been my absolute pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Future Makers Brain and Mental Health. You can find more episodes of Future Makers wherever you get your podcasts, and more on Oxford's research at ox.ac.uk/brain. Thanks for listening.